All of a sudden, there were a bunch of new Trump books. Stephen Colbert said, "We're learning a lot of new details about the last days in office of former president, the Third Reich." Those books have names like Landslide, Betrayal, and Nightmare Scenario, which Colbert said was also how the former president describes having to read a book. Other new books are using titles that are actually quotes of his, like I Alone Can Fix It, and Frankly, We Did Win This Election. These, of course, join the ranks of other great titles like People Are Flushing Toilets 10 Times, 15 Times, The Kidney Has a Very Special Place in the Heart, Person, Woman, Man, Camera, TV, The Book, and of course, in Europe, they live their forest cities. They are called forest cities. They maintain their forest. They manage their forest. I was with the head of a major country. It's a forest city. Colbert, again, the big bombshell from these books is the account of an infamous moment during the D.C. Black Lives Matter protest when the big, strong Law and Order president hid in an underground bunker. The ex-president was so embarrassed when his little hidey-hole adventure was leaked that he reportedly said, "Whoever did that, they should be charged with treason," adding, "They should be executed." Careful, sir, if you start executing people for leaking, you'll have to find a new lawyer. That's good. Fallon said, speaking of Trump, a new book came out that describes anarchy and chaos in the final days of his administration. Yeah, the final days were anarchy and chaos, as opposed to the early days of Omarosa and Scaramucci that were a well-oiled machine, I guess. Fallon, in Trump's defense, he didn't want to stay in the bunker, but once he went down all those stairs, there was no way he was going back up. If you missed yesterday's podcast, good story about how James Gandolfini almost took over for Steve Carell in the later seasons of The Office. Boy, that would have been great. This one from The Guardian, they caught up with Ricky Gervais for the 20th anniversary of the original UK Office. The headline, "We didn't know the rules we were rebelling against. How the Office changed comedy." It wasn't the first comedy to revolve around the cringeworthy antics of a delusional middle-aged entertainer. They give credit to I'm Alan Partridge there. It wasn't even the first mockumentary about the banalities of work. They give credit to people like us. Yet by marrying all those things together and so much more, The Office managed to raise the comedy landscape, establishing a whole new language and style for the British sitcom. The show's producer, Ash Atala, said, "We didn't even really know the rules we were rebelling against. I was very inexperienced. Stephen and Ricky had never written anything before, so at the center of the show were three people who, in terms of track record, had no right to be there. From its DIY attitude to its rejection of comedy's prevailing winds, The Office resembled punk, albeit in a very gray, slough-centric, BBC-abetted way. Its most tangible legacy? It killed off the laughter track." The royal family, which had fought off executives' demands for a studio audience for a few years prior, paved the way, but it was Gervais and company's agonizing onslaught of dead air that seemed to really turn the tide. Alex Owen said, "So much of comedy is to do with the gap between the sense of themselves that a character has and the reality of what they are. It's very convenient if you have a format where they can say, this is what I think of myself, and then immediately show the way it's disconnected from reality. Characters' ability to directly address the camera means they can introduce themselves and plots too, so you don't have to bother with a more traditional story setup. If The Office contributed to the demise of catchphrase comedy and punchline-heavy stand-up, it wasn't exactly an accident. The Office is a comedy about comedy." Atala said, "What we were picking up in the air was that funniness became currency," citing both a culture of wackiness encouraged by the Fast Show and its cartoonist characters, as well as the explosion of stand-up comedians becoming celebrities. When those people who are doing it very well become imitated by the bloke in the pub, that's where it goes wrong. Friend first, boss second, entertainer third, David Brent attempts to fulfill all those roles by acting as a sketch and sitcom jukebox, fitting between some Mothers Do Have 'Em, the two Ronnies, Monty Python, and Harry Enfield and Chums, while speaking of his reverence for comedies. In doing so, he helped demystify comedy, giving audiences a more sophisticated understanding of its social function, as well as drawing attention to the mindless nature of much of its appeal. It is ironic, therefore, that Brent himself became an outsized comic character, his speech patterns, references, and mannerisms all easy to mimic. And everyone did. One of the producers said, "You'd have a lot of audition tapes that would ape the style, and you'd be like, all right, somebody's doing a Ricky." It just became the shorthand. Being Brent was addictive because he sounded like a real person. You almost got locked into the rhythm of speaking in that Brent way. It was a musical thing. I remember writing something at university and being like, I've got to make this sound less like The Office. It was like crack. It was a style he felt echoed through the cringe-tastic scrapes of The Inbetweeners, which is a great show you should watch. That's on Hulu, I want to tell you. Go find The Inbetweeners. Really good. Brentisms didn't just permeate comedy. They found their way into people's actual selves. It became a way of communicating. The quotes, the intonations, the faux arrogance, biting your lip, it almost ruined my life in a great way because I just spoke like that constantly. That's awesome. If Brent is a caricature, his colleague Tim, played by Martin Freeman, is a photorealist portrait We parse Wernham Hogg's work culture through the widening of his eyes. In a sense, he also reshaped the British sense of humor. Detached bemusement is his coping mechanism, and for certain viewers, it provided a blueprint for surviving the banal indignities of everyday life. The reason I'm laughing is because I spent most of the, say, 2005 to 2015 years at meetings in Sirius making Jim Halpert face during meetings just to make myself laugh. I don't care if anybody else thought I was a jerk, but I would sit in meetings and be like, and now I'm making Jim Halpert face. Brent's behavior was in many ways spookily prescient. Thanks to social media, trying to win approval by portraying oneself as funny and considerate has become a universal pastime. Brent is a virtual signaling pioneer. He's so insecure, so he's showing everybody all the time that he's a good guy, he can play the guitar, that he's funny, that he loves to drink, and he's had sex. That's essentially what online behavior is, said Phoebe Walsh. There's no humility on Twitter. That's what David Brent lacks, humility. What a great article this is. You will find that in The Guardian. I suggest you seek it out. From VegWorldMag.com, say it with me, your home for comedy news, Mike Kaplan of Comedy Central, The Tonight Show, and Letterman fame, tap the brakes, press releaser. Mike Kaplan, oh yeah, you know Mike from The Tonight Show and Letterman? Come on, stop. Funny comedian, like him, but Mike Kaplan of Comedy Central, The Tonight Show, and Letterman fame, stop, is the persuasive narrator in a new video for a coalition of animal advocacy groups to combat false advertising by the meat, egg, and dairy industries. The newly formed coalition's first initiative is a satire of traditional commercials called Don't Look, revealing marked discrepancies between industry claims and actual practices known as humane washing. Mike Kaplan plays the persona of many food conglomerates, taking viewers through the various psychological tactics and framing used to convince consumers to purchase factory-farmed animal products. In just over 1 minute, the video breaks down the imagery, language, tone, and tempo common to mainstream ads and juxtaposes them with undercover footage. Animal Outlook's executive director Cheryl Leahy said, "Corporations know that people really do care about animals and don't want them to be mistreated, so they often choose to tell consumers what they want to hear rather than allow them to know the truth. Currently, almost 99% of farmed animals in the U.S. live on factory farms, and we hope this video gives people a glimpse into what we find time and again when we bring our hidden cameras into these places. Cruelty is standard practice. Thanks for making the show funny, Johnny Mac. All right, I'll do another story so we can shake that off. Kathleen Madigan, my friend, spoke to Delaware Online. She took advantage of the pandemic to launch her Madigan's Pubcast. She said, "During COVID, it was so strange to be home. I haven't been off and home for more than 3 weeks in 32 years, so it was odd. Once it was clear we weren't going out on the road anytime soon, I decided a podcast would be a fun way to stay in touch with people. I'd never had the time with the road being kind of all-consuming. I plan to keep podcasting now just because it's been so much fun and something different." Some of Madigan's favorite comedians include Lewis Black, Maria Bamford, Ron White, Ronan Hirschberg, Louis Anderson, Greg Proops, and Roseanne. And that is your comedy news for today. Follow this show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. If you like what I do, buymeacoffee.com/dailycomedynews. If you're on the Instagram, @dailycomedynews. See you tomorrow.